Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Phoenix Business Radio, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studio inside Max 6 Workspace and the Conscious Capitalism Arizona headquarters in Tempe, Arizona, where we help build businesses and connect you with the right people. I'm Daniel Liguori. And today I have the special pleasure to have A.D. Adams, professional musician, on. Welcome, A.D. How are you?
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate my pleasure. I'm really happy to have you in the studio here. Yeah.
Nice digs, man.
I appreciate that.
I like this.
Well, let's introduce you, A.D., how you got into music and what you do now.
Oh, geez. You got time?
plenty of it, yeah.
It's odd, you know, I feel kind of out of place here because it's a business thing here.
Yeah.
And I'm a drummer. You know, come on. But it's, I got into it, obviously, for probably the same reasons most kids did. You know, they saw a band or heard some music they liked, picked up an instrument and did that. Where I sort of took the fork in the road was I kept going with it. I don't want to go to college. I don't want to, you know, but I know what I do want to do. So about the age of 14, I had put a band together a little earlier, actually, but really started putting a band together with my older brother and started playing professional gigs, club gigs at the age of 14. I was touring regional tours at the age of 16 during my high school summer vacations and found out that I could actually make this thing run. So once I graduated high school, my brother and I took it on the road nationally, a little band that we started in our bedroom. And pretty soon we had employees and a payroll and we're doing our own booking and we're doing our travel, you know, travel plans. And so we were basically like, oh, look, we're a business here. So it really started there through a string of different successes and, of course, a million failures in between. But you always look forward to the next bright light. Yeah. So rather than bailing 1,000 times when I had the opportunity, I just kind of kept going. And here I am. I'm 59. I'll be 60 in May. And all these years later, it's like, what have I got myself into?
Wow. That is amazing. So what were some of the bands growing up that you were influenced by? I mean, you grew up in the classic rock era. So who did you get influenced by?
Well, I've already given my age out, so I can go ahead and do this. Obviously, the Beatles. I mean, anybody in my generation who doesn't say the Beatles was not really alive. Yes. I mean, I saw them literally on the first Ed Sullivan non-rerun. So there you go. And I was fascinated with it.
Yeah.
I saw the energy. I'd never seen anything like that. Of course, I'm 5. I hadn't seen many things at all. But the energy it was palpable. Even in our living room, it was palpable with my mom and just on the edge. Like, kids, you need to come in here and watch this. And to thank Mom and Dad for having that consciousness to actually drag us in. It wasn't Topo Gigio and it wasn't the juggling guys. It was musical act that we would usually skip. They called us in and it blew me away. And looking at the drummer,
Ringo,
you know, watching Ringo, I'm like, even at 5, I'm going, that guy's having the most fun. I want to be that guy. And it literally started at that moment. I mean, I could literally say that is the moment.
From watching the Beatles and Ringo Starr.
Yeah. But, you know, then I grew up in and I love shtick. I love fun. I think your music should hit a button in you. It should make you sad and remember something or hit a memory button. Yeah. Oh, that summer at the beach. Or so, you know, then I got into like the humorous side of it. I loved the Monkees. It was prefab, but they had great songs. And oddly enough, I'm teaching the grandson. I teach drums. I'm teaching the grandson of Bobby Hart, who was half of Boyce and Hart, the Monkees' main songwriters.
Oh, wow.
So as serendipity would have it, here we go, full generation. And I just received a book in the as a Christmas present signed by Bobby Hart. One of my first influences was, of course, those goofy Monkees. And but then, you know, Hendrix came along, the Woodstock era. I totally got into, you know, the harder stuff, Zeppelin and Sabbath. I loved Alice Cooper. But again, Alice Cooper, because of the shtick and the show, it's got to be show busy. It's got to kind of, it's got to make me giggle. It's got to make me go, yeah. It doesn't have to be perfect musicianship. As long as it's entertaining and as long as the artist puts out and really makes an effort to make a show, to make it true entertainment, not just get up there and play songs and stare at his shoes.
Right.
That's what influences me, that true entertainment. I'm a huge, huge Louis Armstrong fan. I'm an enormous Sammy Davis Jr. fan. I can't tell you the joy that those two performers. I think Sammy Davis Jr. is the greatest performer of all kind, of any kind that's ever walked on this earth. I am so influenced and blown away by him still to this day.
Yeah, that is certainly amazing. Now, you've played with and know a lot of some prominent musicians. And just looking at the list from your guest form here, the band, the Ramones, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Charlie Watts. That's got to be an amazing experience, right?
It's insane. You know, it can be nerve-wracking, like Chuck Berry. I played with Chuck Berry on stage one time, and I was, 19 years old and scared to death. We were on tour. We were down in Florida, born in the Detroit area, raised in D.C., so my little band was based out of D.C., and we had it on the road one summer, and we were down in, Jacksonville, Florida. Yeah, Orlando, Florida. And we had a Friday, Saturday booked, and the club owner came up with a cassette tape after our first night. And he said, learn these songs if you don't know them. Chuck Berry's going to be coming in tomorrow night, and you're going to be his band. And we're like, well, okay then, just no fear, no pressure here.
Yeah.
Right. And so we did the show, and it was truly the highest high and the lowest low that you could ever have simultaneously.
Wow.
The fact that we're Chuck Berry's band was an amazing thing. I looked, my brother was playing guitar, and we're in the middle of the set, and I'm looking over at him, and he's looking back at me, and we're like, look at us. This is so cool. We're kids, and playing with a legend. It was going great. I thought we did a pretty darn good job. And all of a sudden, Chuck forgot what song he was playing. Now, we had already played Roll Over Beethoven. We were in the middle of playing Nadine. And Chuck looked back at me and started screaming at me, just literally hollering. I mean, daggers coming out of his eyes. Like, what were we doing? And I'm screaming at him, Nadine, Chuck, Nadine. And he forgot. So he started scatting, the words, making up. And he just stopped playing and ripped me to shreds on stage.
Oh,
this old drummer doesn't know what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh. So I shrunk down to about a 2-inch little blob on my drum seat and remained there the rest of the show. Got through it. I mean, it was heartbreaking. I was literally in tears on stage. At the end of the day, I go, dude, I played with Chuck Berry. So,
How was he off the stage? Is he a nice guy, Chuck Berry?
No, he wasn't. Not even. I hate to say that, but.
I've listened to a lot of him. Johnny Be Good was one of the songs that I always listened to.
Right? Who hasn't played that?
He's not an easy guy. He wasn't an easy guy to deal with, Chuck.
No, and it's not just me, and I don't want to talk smack on anybody, but it was, he's legendary for that.
Yeah, that's just part of who he was.
Yeah. He kind of rounded us up before the show and put us in a small room, a little smaller than this that we're in here. And walked around and basically gave us the I'm Chuck Berry speech. If you make a mistake, it's your mistake. If I make a mistake, it's your mistake. And,
I guess that's what makes him the legend he was, Chuck Berry.
He's Chuck Berry, and he can do that, I suppose.
So do you, when you listen to hear his music, do you have to sometimes, forget about that? I mean, appreciate his music for who he is?
I never lost appreciation for him.
Oh, of course, I mean, it's like there's a difference between when you, the musical part of it, and I guess the business aspect of things.
Sure, and I got to meet one of my heroes a couple of times too, Buddy Rich, and it was the same type of thing. He's known for his... he's kind of sharp and a bit abrasive.
Yeah.
So, I was a kid, and when I went to meet him, I was trembling and I didn't know what to say. And so I shook his hand and basically blurted out and asked him if I could have a drumstick. And he just kind of threw my hand back at me like, get out of here, kid. And I was just like, oh, way to go, you dummy.
That's crazy.
But I got to meet him again and redeem myself. And he actually remembered that. So.
Oh, wow. And Stevie Ray Vaughan, you had gotten a chance to meet, huh?
That was a weird thing. That was the weirdest thing. I was on tour and we were in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
And a friend of mine, an old roadie of mine, an old sound man, was now working for the Rolling Stones.
Oh, wow.
So we were playing at a nightclub in Atlanta. My ride's here. It sounds like sirens just went by. I don't know if they could hear that. So we were playing at a club, and my friend knew that. So he got a hold of me. We traded numbers. He knew where we were going to be, our itinerary. Yeah. And he says, well, why don't you come down and watch the Rolling Stones do a sound check? It was a Steel Wheels tour. I think with 80, I don't remember, whatever the Steel Wheels were. So we went into Georgia Tech Stadium, watched the Rolling Stones do a sound check. And then we went out the wrong entrance, didn't come in. Leave the same way we came in, and we saw these huge production trucks. I know what a TV crew looks like, and so wow, there's something going on at one of the frat houses up there. And they were throwing, people were hanging out the windows, and it was loud, and there were lights, and so we naturally walked that way. And Stevie Ray Vaughan happened to be shooting his If the House is a Rockin', Don't Bother Knockin' video.
Wow. Yeah.
So we just showed ourselves in. We were kind of dressed like, you know, we dress. We're musicians, so we have a distinct, you know, a look, I suppose. And we just walked in like we owned the place. Like, hey, you know, we belong here. And they let us walk right in on the set. And I was leaning against a door watching the production. And Stevie Ray Vaughan walked out and sat right next to me, closed the door, and just, we chatted for a little while. It's like, hey, pretty cool thing you got going on
here. Pretty
nice
guy, yeah, Stevie.
Absolutely. True gentleman. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's sad that we lost him. I was only 2 years old when he had died. So it was, I've watched videos. So, I mean, I didn't get a chance to grow up in his era. But I did get a chance to meet Jimmy Vaughan, his brother, at the Rhythm Room. Jimmy is plays a little different than Stevie, but I got a chance to, I guess, know what it was a little bit like with Stevie. I mean, they have different styles, but I know it's he was back in his time, like the next version of Jimi Hendrix, right?
I mean, oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, even as a drummer, you have to appreciate what he did.
Yeah.
You know, how do you reinvent the guitar? How do you reinvent blues?
Yeah.
But he did that. He took a genre that had been played since, you know, the dawn of American music, really, American recorded music, and then some. And then, you know, he's going to have the Hendrix comparisons, but he didn't take it all the way there. He just put his touch on it and left it right there. And I think that that's his legacy, is that he was able to repackage something old and make it absolutely new and absolutely his.
Yeah, and just that kind of that original piece to it all.
Sure.
Yeah, so From that experience, was it, you know, meeting somebody like that, was it just like those wow moments, you know, as you look back?
Yeah.
That's as big as Stevie Ray Vaughan was.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many moments like that. I've been able to be around that, but you learn from that too. You know, I've always taken everything that I've done, every sort of fork in the road or every turn that I've ever made, is that it's a learning experience. Yeah. So if I'm going to be doing, you know, if I've got an opportunity to meet somebody, I'm going to meet them. And I want to meet them on a personal level, not like, hey, you're a rock star. I just want to go, hey, you know, how's it going? What'd you have for lunch today?
It's kind of like whatever. When you were talking to Stevie Ray Vaughan, it was basically like that.
Very casual. It's like, hey, pretty cool thing you got going on here. I mean, I knew who he was, but, you know, I could have gone, oh, Stevie Ray Vaughan. I'm like, hey, bro, you know, kind of. And I think that there's you know, there's not as much of a wall, I think, in between celebrities and rock stars as most people think they are. They're just regular guys trying to make a buck,
people.
Man.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to do their thing. And you know, even when you're a huge rock star, that doesn't mean your next record's going to sell. And you're still in debt to the record label. So a lot of these guys who I think who've really made the biggest success, you know, whether they're still on this planet or have gone on, I think they're aware of that. And I think that they're aware of that they're, you know, they're just dudes trying to find their way. And most of those guys are pretty cool people, you know, the ones who are really secure in who they are. And I, you know, those are the ones you want to learn from. Those are the ones you want to talk to and just sit and chat with and see what makes them tick. You know, it's a pleasure to do that. And so I'm in a great opportunity, you know, in the business that I'm in and the places that I've gone. And I suppose, for lack of a better term, the level that I've achieved, you know, affords that opportunity even more and more now. So, and it's still a learning process.
Right. Now with musicians, I mean, you know, we've seen some great musicians when they leave a legacy behind. I know it's never easy to, the music you're always have of, like we've talked about Stevie Ray Vaughan, Chuck Berry, their music is still around. Is it for the people like Jimmy Vaughan, who's his brother, is it make it a little bit harder for those kind of, when those kind of things happen, is, you know, his brother passed away and he had to go back out and perform? How is it as a musician when those kind of things happen?
I imagine it's there's a sort of many layers to that. I can't help but think about how he's always going to be compared to his brother.
Yeah.
So that's,
Jimmy's,
you know, it's a double-edged sword, really, because it's like, you know, he's good, but he ain't no Stevie or what have you, you know, and that's, you know, that comes with the rivalry, the brother, you know, and or the perceived rivalry, even, you know, sometimes it's.
So how does a musician, I mean, from what you've seen, how do you kind of, like, you know, from a day to day, you know, having the public perception, I mean, him and his brother, and just as a musician, you get over that and say, okay, I am who I am. I'm successful. I mean, have you, on your own personal level and just in general as a musician, how do you do that? Because I know it's talked about a lot.
You just don't lose yourself in the shuffle. Always make sure you know who you are. You know, keep yourself in check. Stay tight with your family. You know, I check in with my daughter, who keeps me on the straight and narrow. You ain't all that, Dad. You know, I'm just Dad. So it's a cool thing. You know, you just really have to, you have to look at it. There's a certain point where I think a lot of people start, you know, playing music because, you know, chicks and booze, you know, and you know, all that. But there's a certain point where they're, you know, where people drop off, you know, and it's like, okay, I got to get a job. I can't sustain this, or I don't want to live the bohemian lifestyle. I'm not willing to, to take that risk and throw everything into it. But I think once you've done that and realize it's a business and that you have to conduct yourself and just present yourself that way, I think that, that you kind of create your own vibe and you know, like I said, you wake up and you go to work every day.
So you just, you have to be, you know, professional, focus, no matter what's going on.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, you if you're a businessman, you know, you generally speaking, you're not going to, you know, show up somewhere like this, in, you know, flip flops and shorts. You know, you want to look, always look, you know, professional, always. And it, you know, I travel an awful lot.
Certainly.
So in the airport, dress like, you know, you're doing something.
Exactly,
it's like, it matters. Not flamboyant to impress people to, hey, look at me, but always impress, because you never know who's going to be at the other end of that terminal.
Like,
you know, you're going to get off the airplane and there's the president of the record label, or somebody's sent to meet you. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like, okay, as soon as we're here, we have to go do this press conference or what have you. That happened to us just last week. It's like, we were doing a rehearsal, and even in rehearsals, I'm not going to wear sweatpants and, you know, I'm going to wear.
Just got to stay professional.
Yeah. Right? So yeah. Here we are sweating, doing a rehearsal, and woman comes in and says, are you ready for the press conference? And I'm like, oh, geez, you know? So we had to do a video press conference. So, like, you know, dress the part, you know, be professional, be on time, but don't forget that you're a businessman. So right. If I'm in the music business, I want to look like a musician. I want people to look at me and go, that guy plays music.
Right.
It just, you know, people talk about networking and all this stuff.
Yes.
That's money you don't have to spend on advertising, because somebody's going to go, you play music? And they always do at the Circle K, at the, you know, and I'm not wearing, you know, like, you know, dressing up like Prince on his, you know, new video shoot. But, you know, you wear something that suits the business you're in and piques curiosity, man. You know,
that's wonderful. Now, as a musician, I mean, we see a musician, you know, playing on stage or, you know, in the recording studio. What does a typical day look like? I mean, every musician is different, but for you, what does that look like? You know, starting in the morning, you know, on the days that maybe you're not performing?
That's good. I mean, the first thing you do, obviously, is you get up and you have your coffee, or in my case, my Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
Or my tea. But, you know, the first thing you do is you check that email. You check your emails. What, you know, what's come in? What the first thing I do every day is open the calendar and open my mail and my messages, because I'm one of those players that I might not. It's a Friday right now. It's a Friday afternoon. I may get a call while we're in here, and the odds are probably pretty good that I'm going to get a call. I need a drummer tonight. And I might get a call from somebody I've never met, and I've got to learn 40 songs by 7 o'clock tonight.
Within a 6 hour time span.
Within or less.
Yeah.
And so I go home, I grab my pen, I grab my music paper, and I start charting. Mm-hmm. And I chart and I write and I write and I write. And sometimes I never play a note. I walk into the gig, shake their hand, and go, nice to meet you. When do we start? You know, and the ability to do that has kept me working. So that's, you know, that's one typical day.
Certainly.
Another typical day would be, you know, I've got a tour coming up and there's some new songs I need to work on. So I head down to the studio. I strap on the headphones for, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours, and I play through the songs and the set or the new stuff, or I rechart. I check my charts, make sure they're correct, you know, and that kind of thing. And then, of course, social media, you want to try to be a little bit hip with that. I'm terrible at it. My marketing skills are just horrendous. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm still in business.
As always, you can always, I guess, learn, continue to learn. That's the way life.
Yes.
That's a good thing. You know, I mean, everybody starts somewhere. So that's a good thing.
So, you know, I mean, so, you know, and then I teach also. I teach drums. So when I'm not on tour, I'm teaching. I have my own private recording rehearsal studio on 19th Avenue in Peoria area.
Perfect.
It's about 750 square feet. It's in a warehouse district. So I can literally, if I wake up in the middle of the night and I've got a song ripping through my head, a brand new song, I can get on my horse and ride on down to the down to the studio and at least lay some basic ideas down, and then you know, go home, go back to bed, and then milk it in the morning or whatever. So it's a constant creative process. You're looking to say, what can I do? How can I market myself? What do I need to do? Do I need to call, you know, I haven't called my sponsor, you know, like I have endorsement contracts, so I need to make an order, or I need to, you know, get a hold of my rep just to say hello. I heard it's his anniversary. So you're constantly that kind of thing. I mean, it's no different than anybody else. I don't sit at a cubicle.
But every day is different.
Every single day is different.
There is no one day that's the same.
Some days are travel days. Some days, tour bus shows up at my front door and I'm on the bus for 32 hours driving to New York.
Is it more like buses than your planes? I mean,
buses and planes. Yeah. We have a full, you know, the typical tour bus, you know, that you see in bands with the big customized tour buses.
So are you more on the bus than planes? It kind of mix. It depends on where you go.
It just depends on what I've got to do. Like if it's a long haul, like if we have to drive, like if we have a gig in maybe New Jersey and there's nothing in between, like it's our first show is in New Jersey and we're doing an East Coast run. That's a 30 some hour drive.
Yeah.
And I don't mind doing the drive, but maybe I've got something that day. We'd have to leave a day early on the bus. And so if I've got lessons scheduled or I've got a gig or some other recording session that I've got to get to, then I'll fly. Otherwise, I'll sit on the bus because I love traveling. I love looking out the window and seeing America drive by and just wonder what's happening in that neighborhood. I've always had this little giddy fantasy. Speaking of the Monkees, there was that, you know, that song Pleasant Valley Sunday. And I used to love that song. And the great opening line is the local rock group down the street is trying hard to learn their song. And we'll be like driving through the mountains of Pennsylvania, you know, and you look down and there's this quaint, beautiful old town with a couple of church steeples and the old red painted houses and, you know, barn colors and just this beautiful little. And I go, which house is the drummer's band practicing in? A little high school. I can never help but think that, like, which house is the band practice happening as we speak? And I just, you know, and then I think about me and, you know, when I was a kid with my brother and stuff. So, you know, it's I love the travel. I love to see the people. I love to see, you know, eat the food. That's always been part of what's kept me in this. It's obviously the benefits of travel and seeing the country where, you know, I can do that on somebody else's dime. People are paying me to go to Sweden. People are paying me to go to England. You know, people are paying me to drive up and down the East Coast and it's wonderful.
Do you usually have like time where you have, I mean, when you book your tours where there's time for yourself to be with your family, you try to like balance it out, have a, you know, some time for on the tour, but time back with the family?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. My, you know, my family, most of my immediate family lives in the DC, Baltimore area. And then my daughter lives in Vegas and our band, Louis Prima Jr.'s band is based out of Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So any excuse I can go to get up there and see her. And I'm a new grandfather. She just had a baby girl. So it's, you know, any excuse I can do that. But downtime on the road is really, really important too. So if you've got an extra day off, you can go sit in your hotel room all day, or you can go, you know, hey man, we're in New York City. I'm going to go do some shopping, or I'm going to go check out, you know, a landmark that I've always wanted to see.
Do something while you're in that city.
Sure. You know, see the land, see the city, you know, eat the food, meet the people. And that's
those kind of things.
That's my passion. That's why I still do this. I certainly don't do it for the money. That's for
so when it comes to venues, I mean, there's many venues throughout America as far, you know, getting, you know, performances booked. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, when it comes to that, just, you know, people that being in connections with to get that done, you know, through whether it's locally or on a national level. Getting the different venues, you know, and the size of them. And
well, I mean, we play with Louis' band, with Louis Prima Jr., we play all size venues. I mean, we've played a record store in some tiny town in New Jersey where you couldn't fit 80 people in there amongst the record bins. And we were squeezed on this little postage stamp makeshift stage. And it was one of the most fun gigs I've ever had. But then we play, you know, huge festivals. There's a festival down in the New Orleans area called Gretna Festival that we play every so often. We used to play it a lot, but then they mix it up. You play 3-4 years in a row, then they don't want to have you for a couple of years. Then they have you back because, you know, they don't want to oversaturate. But, you know, that's 62,000 people.
Right.
So you're doing that. And then we're doing, like, you know, Italian festivals and festivals all over the country, you know, 11, 12, 13, 15,000 people, 5,000 people. We're doing old theaters, like the Rialto type theaters, or, you know, the old state theaters or the, you know, what have you. And those are, you know, 800 to 1200 seats. You know, these old theaters that are built in the 1930s and have ghosts and balconies and ornate, you know, the beautiful old theater. So our venue, and then we do like city wineries all over the country. There's a chain called City Winery that has a very, very good focus on music. And those are about 500 seats. So we do a string of those throughout the country too. So we see in this band, we see kind of every
venues in all parts of the country. The world really. Yeah. Now, let's say to open up for, let's say, a band like, let's say, Aerosmith or the Eagles or bands like that, if you wanted to, you know, partner with them to open up for their shows, is that a longer process? I mean, I know I had Jenny Jarnagin on about a couple of months ago, and she opened up with Billy Gibbons, who was with ZZ Top. To do something like that, does that take a long process? I mean, if you wanted to do that route?
It's networking. It's who you know.
Right.
It's say, hey, you know, it's like, I know a lot of people probably wanted to have that gig. Jenny knew the person who could get her in there. So it's really that, you know, so it kind of goes back to marketing again. People are like, well, how much do you spend on advertising? I go, well, I don't advertise. I don't advertise at all because people in the industry know me right. And the people, you know, and the people I haven't met, I'm going to meet through the people right. I know. And if I need to meet someone, I'll make sure that it's arranged. Hey, I need to meet someone. So and so, or I need to get a message through to somebody, and I think that the further along you go, the more time you spend doing this in this industry, the more people you meet, and if you've got a good reputation, if you're friendly, if you're not, you know, it's kind of a cutthroat business. If people say, hey, you're legit, the guy's okay, they're going to forward messages and you're going to get through to the people who you want to get through to. And I'm sure that Jenny probably knew the right people and said, hey, I want to get this gig, or hey, would you be interested in it?
Right.
Ricky Serrano.
Ricky Serrano. Yes.
Her guitar player, the band I told you about earlier before we started the broadcast, played guitar in that project, Crash Street Kids, where we did the records in my place.
So those things are certainly possible. You know, for opening for bands like I said, the Eagles or, you know, Aerosmith or Journey.
It's funny you mentioned Journey, but way back in the day, I had a management company. It was JP Productions, Jack Utzik, and he was a concert promoter up in New England. And he had put my little band on with Journey and Heart, and we did some shows. And Cheap Trick and stuff like that. So, you know, we knew, like, our manager's booking them. So it's like, we got the gig, you know, we got the gig.
So these things are possible. It's just a matter of, you know, reaching out to people and, you know, being at the right place, the right time, and just continuing to be on top of it. I mean, I guess I can.
Yeah,
certainly it can happen.
And just constantly contribute to your good reputation. Just do what you can to keep a decent name where people go, I like that guy. Right. I like that girl. And I think, you know, I want to work with them. They're friendly. They're personable. And that goes a long, long way in this business.
Now, the styles of music, if like for opening up for a band, even if they're kind of different, can they still consider it? Like if you're maybe somebody that's opening up for Elton John, that's a little bit, and the person that, you know, is essentially going to be opening up, but their style's a little different. Can that still happen? I mean, or is it a little harder to do that?
It's tougher nowadays. I mean, remember back in the day, you look at the Monterey Pop Festival and you've got Jimi Hendrix and you've got Otis Redding. Mm-hmm. I mean, right?
Yeah, there's a difference there with Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding.
Sure, and that, you know, you couldn't be on more opposite ends of the musical spectrum at the time, yet they were doing shows together. And I liked that format. I think it even is visible if you look at the old radio formats. FM radio formats. Yes. When FM radio started taking over in the early 70s from AM radio, you'd have Led Zeppelin, and then right after you'd have Carole King.
That's totally, know? Totally different ends of the spectrum, then, Led Zeppelin,
and it would
Carole
be
King.
Fantastic. Yeah. And then you go, wow. So you're going to get your Gladys Knight, and you're going to get your Black Sabbath. And I think that that's great. I loved the older formats. Now they're a little bit more, they pigeonhole a little bit more. We're only going to play this and this and this. And
it's more narrow now.
It really is. Yeah. And it's programmed from some guy in New York sitting in an office who really is just like, you know, all their 50 radio stations are going to play the same 40 songs on heavy rotation.
Just roll rotation.
Sure. And it's just a racket now, you know. Yeah. Thank goodness for the internet and alternatives. But again, that's a double-edged sword because back in the day, you would do your work, you would get your A&R thing, you would get your record deal, and then your guy, your A&R guy or your promo guy would go to the radio stations and you'd get your airplay, or obviously not. But if it was all clicking, that's what you did. It was that simple. The process wasn't that difficult to understand. Nowadays, you know, there are no major labels. I don't want to say none, but it's more independent. It's back to the DIY thing. And being a band now on the internet, an independent artist, man, you're a needle in a haystack.
As an independent artist.
You got it. Like, what are you going to do? Without being offensive, without being too outrageous and still keeping your musical integrity, that's right. A hard thing to do. It's a hard nut to crack nowadays. And, I, you know, being an older musician, I'm like, whew, man, I'm glad I'm past that. I don't know if I'd have the, you know, the cojones to stick in there this time, you know, to be able to do it without going, I'm done, you know? I mean, I think recently Peter Frampton had posted a thing about, you know, the money that you don't make on streaming. Like for if I've, you know, Spotify, you know, that whole thing, I've got a real issue with those things because I could give you $10 a month and you could go clean out every record store in town and come back for next month and go, all right, 10 more bucks and do the same thing. So that $10 is split amongst all those artists. Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's not much. So I think Peter Frampton said something to the effect of he had I don't know, 14 million streams on something and made a total of $318 or something. Yeah. You know, back then, if those were single sales, he's a millionaire. So I don't know. Where's
it's
my money?
Different.
You know, I don't know. It's a different game now, you know, with the release of music. It's almost like nowadays you just got to get out there, network, get a name, find a project and be able to be versatile. That's one thing that's kept me going is that I can teach. I do a podcast. I you know, I can do sound. A huge part of my career that really leveraged me was when I stopped playing drums for a couple of years, and mixed sound and ended up on a tour, you know, and working in one of the top night spots, you know, in the country at the time. So I was able to, you know, network and meet people like Iggy Pop and Sam Kinison, Bonnie Raitt, you know, that's where I met Charlie Watts and guys like that. So back then you'd put all your eggs in one basket. We're a band. We make records. We tour. Well, it's like, you know, I remember collecting baseball cards, and back then, you know, Willie Mays, he was selling cars in the off season because he wasn't making $8 billion a year.
He had to do something else. And then
in a way, the music business is now like sort of baseball, professional sports used to be. Like, what do you do when you're not on tour? I work at 7-Eleven, you know, or whatever. You got to hustle. You've got to do something.
Right.
Exactly. What are you going to do today? I don't know, but I'm doing something.
So I guess with the music industry and there are maybe are certain musicians that depending on who they are, they can maybe take that time when they're not on tour and be just doing something else. Depends on who you are, really. I mean,
sure.
Certain people, I mean, it depends on what end of the industry you're in.
And in a way you create your own opportunities too. Yeah. When I started touring, you know, and again, I was a kid. I'm still in high school, but I knew we needed a truck, and trucks are expensive, man. You know, I mean, if you're going to rent a U-Haul and go to Florida and back for, you know, 2 weeks, you know, and hit every town in between, you're going to come back with a $2,000 U-Haul bill.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, no kidding. That's 1976. I can
only imagine today's prices. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, okay, so what can I do to make that cost go down? It's like, oh, I know, I'll go work for U-Haul. So everything I've ever done for my job has been geared toward either making me or saving me money. Right. And if you're saving money, you've just given yourself a raise. So, you know, I worked at, you know, a music store for a while in between tours in the late 80s, you know, for about 2 years. And I was able to do that. I learned how to run sound completely by accident on a fluke, but that became something I could do. So I had all these different skills now that I've acquired that I can put to use in recording studios. I took recording studio classes. I was able to parlay that into doing some work down here at the Conservatory of Recording Arts and Sciences. As you know, doing drum clinics and microphone clinics and recording techniques. And I learned that through my side foray into mixing sound at this club, you know, which I knew I needed to do. As I thought to myself, you know, I want to learn as much as I can. So I'm kind of an infomaniac. And even if I'm a drummer, let's say I define myself as a drummer, why wouldn't I learn how to mic drums up? Why wouldn't I understand how about, you know, frequencies and how to mix tones against a bass guitar or a guitar? So all these skills, you know, now make me better. I walk into a recording studio and I can look at the producer, and I've worked with some pretty well-known producers, and I can look at him, make a suggestion and not sound like a dummy, like, hey, shut up, you're just a drummer. You know, I can look at him and say the right things. And he goes, you know, that makes sense. You know, so I've just increased my value. And all of a sudden now this producer goes, this guy's pretty good. I think, you know what, next time I need a drummer, you know, to do some session work, I'll call this cat. And so I've been able to do that. I've been able to network and just kind of parlay every little bit of side knowledge, peripheral knowledge that I've picked up along the way to keep me going, because the tours aren't going to last forever. I don't care what your band you're in, unless you're the Rolling freaking Stones. I don't know what keeps
I guess they would have to do something even when they're not touring. They got to be doing something too. Because I mean, there's 365 days a year. And even the Rolling Stones can't tour all 365. Yeah.
And you know, lucky for, you know, Keith and Mick, they got the cash to just, you know, vacation in the south of Paris. But
they still want to be, I'm sure, like, for even for them, when they're not outside the performing or doing, I mean, they need to be finding time to do something else too.
Sure.
So no matter who you are as a musician, when you're not on tour or not performing, there's something else to be done besides that too.
And you know, there's always too, you know, things can catch up with you too. Like with Louis Prima, you know, we've put out two records. They both done very well. And for jazz records definitely are, you know, jazz, the jazz genre, I should say, is the least selling of all forms of music, country, blues, rock, whatever. Jazz is the least, but the two albums did manage to get us 3 Grammy ballots. So, you know, now the record label, you know, we just did a 5-night stint up in Laughlin. The record label president flew out and we didn't expect that. I didn't know he was coming. And he's like, okay, ready to do 3rd record. So we're like, oh, no, not really, but we'll get on that. So you never know when a deadline's going to be thrown at you. Now you've got this book, that book, this book, all this crazy stuff. You fill in your calendar. You go, I got to start writing. I got to start making demos. So you're constantly reshuffling and rescheduling, but it's a good thing. I mean,
it keeps you busy, and it's not like when you wake up in the morning, you're like, oh, I have something to do today. Yeah,
there's never a day where you don't have anything to do, except for Wednesday. Wednesday, I didn't do anything. I stayed in bed most of the day, guilt-free,
So what would you consider success in the music business? I mean, you know, for like in your goals and just in general, what's considered success to you?
That's a great question. To me, longevity, just to be able to wake up every day and do this and lay down, put my head on the pillow every night and go, I did it again. Wow. Another day doing this. Woo. You know, and I do my little celebratory dance and I go to sleep. That to me is success, to be able to every day do what you love. That to me, my dad, I love him. He's the hardest working guy I've ever known. The greatest inspiration. But my dad would come home from work, and I every morning I'd see him put on the suit and tie, just like every neighbor, get in, you know, this theoretically the same car, drive the same stretch of freeway, you know, to the same job, and come home. He'd loosen his tie, look frazzled, have a martini and a Bromo seltzer, and I'm like, I can't do that. I can't see myself.
And he would
doing
do that day in and day out.
I would murder people. I would
just because it's just the same routine. You wouldn't know the difference in the days.
I'm not capable of that.
Right.
And so to me, success is to be able to say, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to do what it takes to do that. And to have the freedom and the independence to wake up every day and go, I'm still a musician. And in a week, I'm going on tour and I'll be going to England, or I'll be going back in the studio and making another record. You know, I mean, you know, and that, you know, every time you reach a milestone, like these little dreams come true things. Like my dream as a child, I remember watching all the great shows, you know, like the TV shows in the 70s and, you know, watching Chips or whatever, you know, and Eric Estrada's on his motorcycle and he's tooling by the old, you know, Capitol Records building, you know, that round building. And man, the Capitol Records, that's the Beach Boys, man. The Beatles were on Capitol Records. And you're a 10-year-old going, I'm going to make a record there someday. And I did.
At Capitol Records building?
At Capitol Records, man.
What was that experience like?
Surreal. We recorded in this exact same studio. I sang in the exact same microphone that Sinatra, Nat King Cole, Judy Garland sang in. My voice went into that same
microphone.
Yeah. Into the same echo chambers beneath, you know, they have catacombs underneath Capitol Records, their reverb chambers. And I wept. I'm not ashamed to say it. When I walked in there for the first time, I looked up and I saw that building. I stepped in the employee entrance, which was like so awesome. And I walked in, you had to sign the register, and literally a teardrop went onto the registry. So I soiled their registry with my, you know, with my exuberance. And, but it was absolutely surreal, because some of the greats have recorded there, you know, and you look around the room and you can feel the ghosts, but then at the same time you go, I'm here. I,
You made it there.
I made it here.
Yeah.
And that to me is success, to be able to achieve those little dreams, those little things. And then at the end of the day, you know, I have a record. I have an album from that. And I can hand that to you and go, that's what I did. And long after I'm gone, somebody's going to be able to put that record on and go, that guy was okay. You know, nice little bunch of tunes. And if they're tapping their feet, then I'm still around.
Wow.
You know, and that's kind of, that's to that me is very inspiring.
That is amazing. As far as like the royalties, and I know you've you mentioned this maybe a little bit, what the difference is now with the piracy, the streaming versus was when you first started in the music industry?
Man, it's nothing. I mean, most, you know, you talk about the cost of living increases and things like that.
It does.
You know, you can take any aspect of the industry and it is just not the same. I mean, even let's not even talk about royalties for now because we and we'll get into that.
But certainly.
Let's just talk about, let's say you're a local bar band and you're playing at down some, pick a club, any club, right?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, back in the day, you could pretty much count on if you were just a regular local band and weren't, you know, packing the place. I mean, there were some bands that would pack a place and make a lot of money doing that. My band was fortunate to do that after a while, but you'd be lucky if you walked out with $100 a man. Lucky. And, you know, nowadays you go to any club here in Phoenix 30 years later and maybe make $80 a man.
And so, that would be no matter really what band it is.
Sure. Now, some guys pay more. Some band, you know, clubs pay more, some pay less. And I guess it depends on what, you know, how well they draw like that, obviously. But
so that's a rough about average.
The money, the money hasn't gone up. So
now, is that changed by the market or pretty much every market? It's similar, whether it's in Phoenix or Las Vegas or Los Angeles,
well,
Denver.
You know, there's a different face in Las Vegas. Las Vegas has show things and the budgets are a lot higher.
Right.
But there's a lot more competition.
So you have a lot more bands there.
You bet.
And you have all the more other genres of music and some of the big names that are out there.
Yeah. So, you know, so you got to hustle a little bit more, you know, for your
so the pay for like a band would be maybe more there, but I mean, there's also more competition that you're going up against.
So what I do now, I also, I work with a bunch of other bands. I'm not only a drummer, you know, for Louis Prima Jr., but I'm also a freelance. Like I'm considered an independent artist, although I am contracted with Louis. And so my contract with Louis basically says you'll be available when we need you, you know, to record. If we need to write, you know, do a writing session, you're available, which is great because we do the writing and pre-production at my studio down here, which is fantastic. But you agree to that. But, you know, what do you do on the side? Well, I'm making records also. There's a local cat. I shouldn't say local. He's actually from England. A cat named Paul Gervitz. Now, his claim to fame was after Cream broke up. You remember the band Cream?
Certainly do. Eric Clapton. I love Cream. Yeah.
And I'm
well before my time, but I love listening to him. Yeah.
Right. You know, come on. You got to love him, right?
Yeah.
And Ginger Baker was their drummer, their eccentric drummer, who I was a huge fan of, still am.
Yeah.
After Cream broke up, Ginger Baker had a band called Baker Gervitz Army.
Yeah.
Well, Paul Gervitz and his brother Adrian were the Gervitz half of that, or two thirds of that. Paul lives here now. He moved from England. He lives out here in the Gilbert area and saw me at a club and is producing records. So I also play with him and I do records with him. He just called me to do a session for a guy. So it's like, okay, royalties. Do I think this record that Paul hired me to do, because he was producing it, and he said, well, you know, what do you charge? And I said, well, here's what I normally charge, you know, to do a session per song. You know, and because it's you, I'll give you a break. But now oftentimes I could have given him a better deal, like less cash, and said, but I want 3 points on the album. But I'm not as apt to do that anymore because of the streaming and the loss that you'll take. So nowadays I'm not on the side. I don't contract for royalties unless it's like if Sinatra came up, or Sinatra Jr. came up and said, hey, we're going to do a record. Like, I get points on Louis Prima's records because I'm one of the principal songwriters. But with this, if I'm a hired gun, I'm going to go for the cash. Just pay me this much. I don't want any points. Because it's at the end of the day, it's paperwork that's not even worth the paper.
It's not worth your time in the end, right?
Yeah, and that's not to put down the project that you're doing. It's just that the record industry doesn't allow that. It just doesn't allow that anymore. You could have a number one record and still not make much money at all. So royalties are kind of a thing of the past, but I can tell you the number is very, very small. The percentage, I think for every stream, which would normally be an airplay on radio, for every stream, I think it's 0.0039 cents Like, what is that?
So you would have to go into the probably into the billions before it equals out.
Sure.
So when you hit into the billions, then it's profitable. But until you get to that level, then, you know, you're going to the other direction.
So locally, I've been fortunate to hook up there. There's a local record label called Slope Records, and they're doing a great thing. They're kind of in the punk genre, and I've been with some punk bands and done some videos and some tours and stuff like that. And I was called, there's a cat named Dwayne Peters, and he's an old skate punk. He from way back in the day, he was Tony Hawk's hero.
Yeah.
And so he got a punk band together after his sort of semi-retirement from, you know, the skate world. And he did well. He kind of a cult following. He lives out in California. So Slope Records, they got a cool thing where they'll call him up and go, "Hey, you're broke. I know you got some songs, but I've got a producer. I've got a record label out here. I've got a studio and I've got a stable of musicians. Come out and do your record." So I'm a hired gun for them.
Yeah.
So Dwayne Peters' record came out. It's US Bombs is the name of the band. And it's called Road Case is the name of the album. I'm on that album. I'm all over that album, but you won't see my name on it. Wow. Not a mention, because they paid me. So I do what they call ringer work as well, which, you know, is you make your money, but you don't get the glory.
But you are getting, at least you're getting compensated back.
Yeah,
for it.
Yeah, I'm making my money on that.
Now,
so.
Now 2019, I know we briefly talked off air about this. You'd mentioned about the Rhythm Room, you know, Bob Coratore,
yes,
the owner,
yes.
And you'd like to hopefully play there. Here in 2019, right?
Oh, gosh, I played there a bazillion times. I couldn't count how many times I played with and brought shows into their Dick Wagner show I did with Dick. Matter of fact, my band Crash Street Kids, who had recorded in my studio, were his band. So we hooked up with Dick Wagner and said, "Why don't we do a show? And why don't we do it at the Rhythm Room?" So it was a huge success.
So your next show, if you were to do at the Rhythm Room, what would that look like if you were to go on there?
You know, I've recently made good friends with a woman named Becky Barksdale. Now, Becky's claim to fame, ultimately, you know, way back in the day, she toured with Michael Jackson. If you look at the old, "Doesn't matter if you're black or white." You know, there's a great video, a couple of great videos. She's just so, can I say badass? She's so totally badass. She's got this giant red mohawk. So Google Becky Barksdale, Michael Jackson, and just watch this video. So Becky and I made friends with Becky at a gig in Las Vegas, where she came with a friend of mine, a rock star who I idolized as a kid and never met, and met him on Facebook, and he brought her along. We hit it off. So Becky's got a blues project. Now, her primary gig is she writes television shows, music, and movie soundtrack work. But she loves to play live, so she's got a great electric blues thing going, but she doesn't have a steady band. So she and I have been talking about, well, why don't we put a blues, rock and blues trio together, electric blues trio, and have at it, you know, and play whenever we want to. You know, we'll work around each other's schedules. And she's like, "Oh, let's go."
So that would be like an ideal kind of show at the
Absolutely.
Rhythm Room.
Absolutely. So it's Becky Barksdale. Bob, if you're listening, Becky Barksdale, let's get that thing booked. We will
have some fun. That is certainly awesome. Yeah, it really is a fun place to play from what I've heard from. And I know Jenny Jarnigan, who I had on, will have her CD release party in February there. And we've had a lot of great musicians go through there at the Rhythm Room. So
it's a great room. I was there one night and I Lee Oscar, remember the band War?
Yeah.
I was playing and Lee Oscar was playing and he wanted to get up and jam with us. So I was able to, I can say I played with Lee Oscar, which was an amazing experience. I mean, you know, we're playing low, right? There, and I'm going, "This is so cool. That's the guy." And he's blowing the harp and I'm losing my mind. And, you know, the thing is, I'm still a fan. That's, I think we were talking earlier about what keeps you going and what's motivation in the morning. I'm still a fan. I'm still that little 12-year-old boy. And when I buy that new album, I look at it and I'm grinning ear to ear and I'm reading all the lyrics and I'm still the same kid inside. So little 12-year-old me right now is giving 59-year-old me some high fives going, "You old, look at you go, you old man." Yeah. And, you know, so yeah, that's the kind of thing that it really motivates me, you know.
One of the things I wanted to touch as we round out here is what the dangers and the pitfalls of being in the industry and what, you know, what that looks like. You know, you had mentioned that on here, I guess.
Drugs and alcohol, man. Drugs and alcohol. And, you know, and I don't hold much back. I'm kind of an open book for a couple of reasons. I have a child, a daughter and a stepson, but I also have students. Young students, older students, drum students. And I want them to understand this business. It's not just about, can you bang out a great groove? Can you play to this Zeppelin tune? Or can you, you know, can you march and play a paradiddle at the same time? It's about surviving in this business and all that. And some of these people that I teach do go into the business. And so I want them to have the full education. I want them to know who I am that legitimizes what I teach them so they can look me in the eye. I can look them in the eye and they can say, this guy knows who he's talking about. Drugs and alcohol are the reason I'm here in Phoenix. I literally had two overdoses. I flatlined the second time, and I'm not supposed to be here right now. So by the grace of whatever we all find holy or none of the above, but I'm here. And having survived that, it was one of those things where if I don't leave D.C., I'm done. It's over. There's nothing left. And so I literally threw my phone book away. Burned it, literally came out here with no phone numbers and a rental truck. I literally threw a dart at a map and that it landed kind of near Tucson. And I went, ah, Phoenix, you know, and I moved out here. I didn't know anybody. I started completely over and I had, what, $80 in my pocket, nowhere to live when I moved here. And I said, all right, I gotta do something. So I was able to scrape some money together and, just as fortune would have it, I was, you know, I'm thinking about what I can do, what I have to do. I wasn't even in town for a week. I was fortunate to get a job teaching at a drum shop on the West Side. Thank you, Clint, over at Boogie Music Drum Alley back in 92. And he took a chance on me and I appreciated it. You know, I was just still trying to be clean. I was sober. And so I got my first paycheck and I was at a bar and grill near my house having a steak and cheese sandwich. And some guy walks up next to me, sits down, and he goes, are you a musician? And I said, yes, I am. And he goes, I need some help. I'm a film producer. And I went, okay, what kind of film are we talking about here? And turns out it was Johnny Knoxville's first motion picture that was filmed here in Phoenix, a horrible film called Desert Blues. And when I had moved to town, I had a bunch of songs that I had written with a writing partner back on the East Coast. And he retired from the business. And I said, what should I do? He goes, sell those songs, do whatever you can. So the initial approach was, I need a song for a film. And I said, well, I've got 20 of them. And I said, if you want one, I said, let's have a meeting. And I'll play them for you. So this was before CDs were, you know, be popular. So I had 11 or 12 separate cassette tapes all queued up. And I know they don't want to hear the crap. So I had it queued up right toward the chorus. So I had my meeting and I said, okay, boy meets girl scene. And I popped that cassette in. I go, there's your boy meets girl scene. Boy breaks up with, or girl breaks up with boy. Here's your sad song. And one after the other, I made my presentation. Well, by the time it was all done, I had 11 songs in that film. It was Johnny Knoxville's first movie. And at the time, Dan Marley from the Phoenix Suns' wife was in that as well.
Wow.
Crazy cast of Phoenix characters. So welcome to Phoenix, little A.D. Adams. You know,
this
so
was 1992.
This was 92. August, wow. August, maybe September by then of 92.
Of 1992.
So, yeah, it was one of those things where it's just like, wow, okay, things are going. And at that point in time, now remember, I just overdosed. I didn't know what I was doing. In my mind, I kept thinking, maybe I'm done. Maybe just this is going to kill me and I shouldn't be doing this anymore. And sure enough, all of a sudden, damn it. Look, I'm right back in this again, doing a movie project. And from that, he needed a band. The guy needed a band in the film. So I called some people I had met. And happened to have run into an old friend of mine from New York City. The craziest thing, needle in a haystack, ran into him out here in Phoenix.
Yeah.
And I said, help me put a band together. So we were actually in the film. And, and from that point on, I'm back in the business again and going full steam ahead. And I'm like, I can't quit. It's like, somebody let me off of this thing. And I just can't. So, you know,
that
kind of
amazing. Yeah.
Go where fate takes you and you steer it as best you can. And sometimes you just got to ride the current as well.
You just got to ride that storm out.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
Certainly. So how can our listening audience that's listening get a hold of you, AD, if they wanted to connect with you via social media?
I'm on all the Instagrams, the bird one, the Facebooks, the face plants, and just go to any of those. And it's A.D. Adams, A period, D period Adams, or A.D. Adams without the punctuation. You can also get a hold of me at louisprimajr.com. That's L-O-U-I-S-P Prima Jr. That's Louis Prima, son of the great legendary jazz artist Louis Prima, who was responsible for, you know, the Jungle Book. He was King Louis in the Jungle Book, and Sing Sing Sing, he wrote that. Sunday Kind of Love, the Reba McEntire, he wrote that. People don't know that. So I work with Louis. And also I do that podcast. Now, I told you about a podcast called the Shabby Road Record Show. It's Abbey Road, but kind of Shabby Road Record Show. And it's an all vinyl podcast. So you can hit me up on the, shabbyroadrecordshow.com too. It's all vinyl, free form. We're on iTunes, iHeartRadio, all the podcatchers, whatever they call them. And it's been 4 years and we're doing gangbusters. We're about to do our 200th episode. So you can hit me up on any of those social media sites through Louis Prima or myself or the Shabby Road Record Show.
That's certainly amazing. Yeah. Will you have any shows here in Phoenix coming up that our listening audience might want to come out to see you?
Well, we're hoping to get that Becky Barksdale gig at the Rhythm Room. So hopefully, and you know, I work with Otto Dagnolo also. He's a great, great producer from here. He works with Lyle Lovett, Nils Lofgren, and all these cats. So I've been known to play with Otto on some local shows. Awesome. Paul Gervitz has been doing some local shows. So with that, and I actually play with this local kid, this kid named Evan Berg. He's 22-year-old gunslinging. This kid's good. And he plays a bunch of cover music. And he called me to do a couple. I need a drummer and I need one in 2 hours. So I'm like, come out and play his shows. And he and I have hit it off. We're a generation apart, generation and a half even maybe.
But you're still getting along and playing some great music.
This kid is talented. Evan Berg, look him up. He plays in Scottsdale a lot, but he's a really talented kid. We played as a trio, and there's a local bass player out here, another Detroit boy.
There you go.
Yeah, Detroit.
That's so awesome.
So I'm doing a lot. I'm busy, man.
Yeah.
We're trying to get Louis Prima booked at the Musical Instrument Museum in March. So I'm working on that right now. So keep your ears peeled for that too.
That is wonderful. Yeah, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you so much for being here on this Friday afternoon and sharing all your stories, your successes, and everything about the music industry.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, it was really great to talk to you here today. But you've been listening to Phoenix Business Radio with Business Radio X, broadcasting live from within the Max 6 and Conscious Capitalism Arizona studio. Some media leans left, some lean right. We lean business. Until next time, I'm Daniel Liguori.